cool to think that, you know, these are the original fish that were here before man had much of an impact. I wanted to take that concept and take it to retail. We essentially give 2% of every purchase back to a different conservation-based nonprofit every quarter. We contacted my daughter's teacher and asked, you know, would they be interested in seeing this heart? Because I had this giant heart from this bull elk. Technology's actually come far enough now that they actually just discovered another lineage that they thought had gone extinct. It's such a different country. You know, I spend so much time chasing deer and elk that it's, I guess, refreshing is the best word I can just use to describe it, because it's just different country. This is Eric Myrie from Basin and Bend, and you're listening to the Wild Initiative Podcast.
Put down your latte and pull on your boots.
I've been blessed to harvest 22 of the 29 North American animals with my bow.
My personal 24-hour record for death threats is 88.
They will start putting two and two together and realize this is how you call bulls in.
So when I go hunting now, that's the ethos I take with me. You know, whatever this hunter's going to throw at you, you pull your big girl pants up and you get on with it.
Giant bucks are freaking awesome. They're beautiful. But you know what? I would not trade this first buck for anything in the world.
So I'm a geek. Magicians and dragons and magic swords. I kid you not, man. I'm the biggest dork in the gun business.
I'm Freddie Hartice, Hollywood Hunter.
This is Aaron Snyder.
Hey, this is Trevin Stolzus with Outback Outdoors.
This is Rihanna Carey.
Hi, this is John Sloan of Interviews with the Hunting Masters.
You're listening to The Wild Initiative.
Hey, y'all, welcome to another episode of The Wild Initiative, brought to you as part of the Waypoint Outdoor Collective. All right, y'all, so getting on to today's episode. I am out here in Colorado. I have been wandering around like a homeless person for a couple of weeks now, and I made my way up to the little mountain town, the picturesque mountain town of Blackhawk, Colorado. I am here with the one and only Eric Myrie of Basin and Bend. We just finished up a little short, I guess, half day on, where were we?
That was actually South Boulder Creek.
South Boulder Creek. Okay, because I had no idea. but yeah, came up to just say hello and do a little podcasting, do a little fishing, and it was a good day. We finished up my my 3-day weekend slam is what I'm referring to it as.
Exactly.
I guess so. The slam, technically, what you have to catch all four species of trout in one day, right?
Technically, yes.
So I was going for the slam, didn't manage to get the slam. So then we were going for the weekend slam, which is totally a thing. And that didn't quite work out, but it's Monday. It could be an extended weekend if it was done on a holiday. So I'm calling this the extended weekend slam.
While you're in the borders of Colorado, you made it happen. So
there we go.
There you go.
There we go. I think it counts. Either way, it was awesome. It was really fun. And again, you know, as my friend Katie, a Fish and Tame, puts it, you know, you guys here in Colorado are really putting me on the monster fish is what it comes down to. I genuinely think, like, the two yesterday at the time were the smallest fish I'd ever caught. I genuinely do not think, short of like scooping one out of a fish tank in a pet store,
right,
do not think I've caught anything smaller, which I mean was still cool because it was the first cutthroat I'd ever caught in Colorado state fish, which was awesome. And so I was really excited. That was the one thing I really wanted to catch a cutthroat while I was up here. And I got my first brown trout as well. I've caught rainbows before, you know, fishing. And then smallest fish until today.
They seem to keep getting smaller too. So,
and yeah, I was like progressively tinier and tinier. I think it was a brown that was that really teeny, the one that almost looked like a sardine.
Yep.
Or was that the brookie?
The brookie definitely, yeah. The fly was almost bigger than the fish was. I mean, you could have compared them side by side, and it would have been a pretty close race. But yeah, I think it was the brookie that was the smallest. But you know. It was colorful. We'll say that.
It was, and it, to be completely honest, like I'd almost rather, you know, unless I'm catching some like a giant, like just a really big fish, I'd almost rather catch something so ridiculously small it's entertaining. It's like those fish in the middle. It's like, okay, cool. You know, I got a fish.
Right.
But like, I'd kind of want to catch both ends of it. I'm always on both ends of the spectrum. I'm a man of extremes.
It's a different level of challenge to try to catch a fish that's so small that it literally can barely even get the fly in its mouth. So that there's something to be said about that.
I mean, that thing, I don't think it could have legitimately closed its mouth around that fly.
No.
Hopefully I'll have posted the picture by then on Instagram or something. But so if you guys are listening to this and I have posted a picture of what looks like a sardine with a giant fly in its mouth, that is my first brook trout. So what does the slam consist of?
So, you know, in Colorado, we basically have the four main species. So we have cutthroat trout, and there's subspecies within the cutthroat family. But, you know, our official state fish is the greenback cutthroat trout, which for the most part, you know, anybody that's kind of been following the history of the state fish over the past 20 years or so, there was a little bit of a dispute, because back in the day, we actually just identified some of those subspecies by their look, you know, how they kind of looked. When you would compare two different ranges, you could see that there was a little bit of difference, but you couldn't necessarily scientifically prove that they were of different lineages and all that. So a lot of people are looking for the cutthroat trout, but the greenback cutthroat trout, but until recently, there actually weren't true greenbacks on the landscape. They were thought to be extinct, and the ones that were out there were typically some type of hybrid, usually a Colorado River cutthroat that may have had some greenback genetics in it. But until just the past couple of years, actually Basin and Bend has been involved in putting some of the true genetically, you know, as pure as we can get them that we've found in Colorado back on the landscape in a few different ranges across Colorado. So that subspecies, the greenback, is what is actually our true official state fish. But that, like I said, that's just one of the cutthroat species. Mm-hmm. The rest of the slam would be your brown trout, your rainbow trout, and then the brook trout. All three of those are actually introduced species to Colorado. Okay. So those were brought here by the hand of man. And, you know, have kind of evolved into some of the different watersheds and all that. But that greenback and the Colorado River cutthroat were the ones that were in most of the drainages here in Colorado, as well as the Rio Grande and a few too. So
tell me a little bit more. You mentioned that, you know, Basin and Bend is involved in effectively kind of repopulating the greenback cutthroats mm-hmm. as pure as you can find as
right.
possible. Tell me a little bit more about that.
So it's actually it's a super interesting story. So like I said, the greenback was thought to be extinct, and I don't remember the exact year off the top of my head, but they essentially discovered a remnant population down in Bear Creek. And there's a few different Bear Creeks here in Colorado, but it's the one that's down kind of near the... No, I'm going to forget the mountain name. down by Pike's Peak.
Okay.
It's down off of Pike's Peak down there. And literally, there's only a few hundred fish that what was so interesting about it is, like I said, they thought they had found... They thought we had greenback here until that point, which was native to the South Platte drainage. So most of these drainages that come down on the east side of the Continental Divide into the Front Range eventually drain into the South Platte drainage. And so that greenback was a native to that particular drainage. And so they thought they had found them. And so they started stocking some of these different what they thought was the greenback into a lot of the high alpine lakes, a lot of the lakes up in Rocky Mountain National Park, and so on. But as technology evolved and science evolved, they were actually able to compare the genetics or the DNA of those fish, this little population that they found mm-hmm. Down by Pike's Peak, with an old remnant, basically a sample that had been taken, you know, in the early 1900s, late 1800s, that was actually in the Smithsonian Institute. And they were able to...
So like that, legitimately that old, a sample is still chilling around and it's still viable.
Still viable, yeah, in the Smithsonian. And like, and that's what I was saying, you know, with the way that the science has progressed and the technology, they were actually able to take a sample from those new fish that they found in this little creek with that old sample, and we're able to determine, yes, these are actually genetically the same, and this is actually the lineage of that original fish that was here. It hasn't been compromised with, you know, crossbreeding with other species and things like that. Mm-hmm. So a project was launched essentially to try to, you know, reclaim those fish and bring them into the hatchery system so that we could, you know, fully populate that lineage out and then start putting it back on the landscape. So, like I said, it's an ongoing activity that's been going on with Colorado Parks and Wildlife. You know, Trout Unlimited's very involved in that. Even the Fish and Wildlife Service. So a lot of these different organizations are active in that, but they rely on volunteers a lot to actually help get the fish up in the drainages because it requires a lot of manpower.
Yeah.
The most recent one we did was up in Poudre Canyon, but we've done other ones throughout Colorado as well. But we literally, you know, I think they had like 50 volunteers showed up. We all had backpacks, and we literally had a truck arrive from the hatchery that had the pure greenback cutthroat in it. We each carried about a 5-gallon bag of water that was then filled up with air, you know, so a little, mm-hmm. just enough water to get about a dozen fish in it, fill the rest of it up with air, put it in the pack, and then up the mountain we went.
It's like a giant, when you go to the pet store and you get the big, right. the big bag. So it's like a giant
it
version
totally
of that.
Yep.
I love it.
It absolutely is. But yeah, that's kind of the first step. You know, I mean, CPW goes through a lot of these, a lot of studies, a lot of scientific research and things like that to figure out drainages that have a good habitat, you know, so these fish have a good opportunity to survive. They have to go in and make sure all the non-native fish are out of there. So if there are brook trout in there, mm-hmm. if there are, you know, maybe mixed breed cutthroat trout in there that need to be removed, they'll go in and do that and basically prepare the drainage for these pure fish. A lot of times it also requires some type of barrier, fish passage barrier at the bottom of the drainage, so fish can't come up from other drainages and things like that from another river or something and move up in there, mm-hmm. and kind of spoil that population, if you will. So it's involved, and it's you know, ultimately it's quite a bit of money to
Yeah.
When you think about it, you're just putting fish in a little creek or, you know, a little river or whatever. So, but it's cool to think that, you know, these are the original fish that were here before, you know, man had much of an impact as we did, you know, when we started migrating west and all that. So,
how long ago was this that you guys did this?
The most recent one was, I believe, in mid-July in the Poudre. But like I said, I've done it multiple years. There's a drainage up kind of near the Eisenhower Tunnel that Herman Gulch up there has a population that's been established there as well. And that one has gone through multiple years worth of stockings. And, you know.
So this has been going, you've been doing this for
yes.
several years
yep.
then. Okay.
Yep. Yeah.
Wow. Like how many, I mean, just if you had to just throw out a guess, like how many, like over the years you've been doing this, how many of these greenback cutthroats would you say you've been part of the
restocking? I've probably been part of maybe half a dozen, something like that.
You're dropping like each person and is dropping like you're saying like 5 to 12 or something like that.
Yeah, it's usually 12 to 15 fish.
Oh, that many? Okay.
Yeah.
I guess in a 5-gallon bag.
But
it
depends on what age class of the fish that they are that they're putting in there, mm-hmm. you know? So this last one, they were actually a little bit larger fingerling that went in
okay.
there. So, you know, they're at a further development stage.
It's kind of funny. You know, like you say that, and at first I picture like, you know, like big old full size. And I'm like, man, like 50. And then I'm like, no, of course not.
Right,
like,
no. No, they're just small little folks that, yeah.
Kind of like what some might catch.
right. They'd be right up your alley. But no, it's a cool project to be a part of. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was really neat for my daughter to be involved in that last one, you know, because we come back a decade from now and, you know, we go into that drainage and now, you know, we're going to have these pure fish in there and we can go up and enjoy that experience and go back and see them. So it's kind of neat.
That's really exciting. And so there, you have been seeing results though, like you've been seeing these populations grow and.
Yep. They're starting, you know, and that one in Herman Gulch, that's one that like I said, they've done multiple stockings because they weren't getting, you know, the take rate, if you will, in the creek as much as they wanted. They wanted more surviving over the winter and stuff like that. So they kept putting more in there just to get the population kind of kickstarted to get going.
So if there was, if like, say somebody was listening, they're local, fairly local to call, you know, here in Colorado, when they wanted to get involved in something like this, what, reach out to you, reach out to
I mean, that's one thing we focus on quite a bit. You know, we try to stay active in a lot of the different conservation organizations and their activities. But yeah, Trout Unlimited would be a really good place to start. If they're not a member, they can contact any. There's a lot of local chapters, especially here in Colorado, but across the West, well, I guess even across the country, there's local chapters just about everywhere that they could get involved. But yeah, if they were here in the West, there's volunteer coordinators that, you know, send out emails and keep people abreast of what's going on. So pretty easy to get involved if you're willing to.
That's awesome. That's really cool. I didn't know. I mean, I kind of knew a little bit about the history of them. You know, I knew that they were thought to be extinct, and and then, you know, people found it. But I didn't know about all the restocking initiatives. And
yeah,
that's really, really cool.
It's interesting because that technology has actually come far enough now that they actually just discovered another lineage that they thought had gone extinct. And they're actually able to prove that it's a separate subspecies. I may misspeak here, but I believe they're referring to it as the San Juan cutthroat trout. So now we've got a new species that, as soon as they discovered it, there was a fire that was bearing down on that valley. So they actually had to send in people to get those fish out of there before that fire came through. And they did end up saving a bunch of them and getting them into the hatchery system to, you know, kind of propagate the numbers. And I believe this last summer they just started putting some of them back into the original watershed now that that fire had gone through and the, you know, soil had stabilized and things like that a little bit. So
that's wild. That's crazy.
Yeah. It's pretty bizarre because we actually, there was another subspecies up outside of Leadville that was kind of, from what I understand, was a little bit similar to the Lahontan out in Nevada, you know, where it had the ability to get really, really large.
Okay.
So it'd be cool to see if they ever found remnants of that one here in Colorado as well.
That's the fact we have that technology now and we can, it blows me away.
Yep.
You know, and it's so cool to me. And I'm assuming a lot of the funds for this comes from Pittman. No, Dingle Johnson.
Dingle Johnson would be on the fishing side.
Yep. I was like, no, that's not. That's the hunting one. I'm assuming that comes through federal funding, goes to the states, and they can.
Yep.
That's really cool.
They can apply for those. Yep. Yep. For those funds, and then, you know, it's literally up to millions of dollars. You know, I mean, it's some serious money, so it's a good program.
So one thing we kind of just got right into it, but I usually start with is a little bit of an introduction just about yourself and you know, what you do and who introduced you. How did you get into hunting and fishing and the outdoors, all of this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, that's I was lucky. So I actually grew up, you know, within a 5-minute bike ride as a child from the Mississippi River in Wisconsin. And I spent every waking moment of my summers literally down playing in the water, you know, chasing panfish and sunnies and bass and pike and stuff like that. And then it just happened to be that my dad and my uncles were pretty avid hunters as well. So I, you know, from age 12 on, I was always out hunting as well. So I just kind of grew up around it. You know, just our entire family was an outdoor based family. So I had that instilled in me at a young age. And I kind of became enamored with the West. I guess after high school, finished up college back in the Midwest, but moved out West pretty much immediately after out here to Colorado. And, actually didn't do much of the fly fishing until I moved out here. even though I lived in one of the best areas in, you know, they call it the Driftless area. They're kind of those three corners of Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. There's a lot of really good fly fishing up there and trout fishing. It wasn't until I came out here, I had a coworker that literally one day on a lunch break had a coworker take me out to Boulder Creek, which was kind of the next drainage up from where we were today, and ended up catching my first trout. And at that point, I couldn't even tell you what type of trout it was. I knew it was a trout, but couldn't tell if it was a brown or a rainbow. But yeah, ended up catching it during our lunch break. And that just kind of totally sealed the deal. And I just kept getting further and further into it. And just, you know, given my childhood history and all that, it's just what I kind of wanted to be. I'd come from the technology industry and had been in that for quite a while after I moved out here to Colorado, but eventually moved into the outdoor industry and ultimately started my own business, which is based in Bend. And, you know, now it's a fly fishing and hunting retail operation that basically focuses on, you know, more than just the retail aspect of it. You know, you were kind of mentioning the Pittman Robertson and the Dingle Johnson. It basically, I wanted to take that concept and take it to retail. So we essentially give 2% of every purchase back to a different conservation based nonprofit every quarter. And we usually switch that up on a quarterly basis and work with a specific project that that money can be kind of earmarked for. That way we help, you know, not only provide some funding for the conservation organization, but also, you know, I see it as almost becoming a bit of a marketing arm for those conservation organizations, you know, because I'm constantly trying to introduce people to these different organizations, but keep people, you know, abreast of what's going on with the organizations. I think they're always really good about trying to get funds from donors and that type of thing, but keeping people informed of what is actually happening after the fact, you know, what happens after a project actually gets greenlighted and, you know, 3-4 years down the road, what's going on, you know, with this habitat restoration or this public land, you know, purchase or something along those lines. So that's kind of our goal is to use the retail model to help fund conservation.
See, I think that's such an important thing and something people forget. You know, we talk a lot about like the funds, you know, hunting is conservation, fishing is conservation, the whole thing. We talk about the funds from our purchases, from our licenses, from all that stuff, but we really don't talk that much about the private donations too, from companies that are donating a portion of every purchase, from memberships to conservation organizations, from just straight up donations people make because they want to support these projects.
Right.
And it's, I mean, you know, Pittman Robertson and Dingle Johnson is what, over like $1.3 billion or something this last year?
It adds up to a lot.
I don't know if it's even possible with like all the insane amounts of conservation organizations out there, but I'd be interested just to know like what over and above that. I don't know if anybody's ever done the research.
That's a good point, yeah.
Like over and above that, what do... Because, and that's the other thing, is because you know, the people that are members of those organizations, they're hunters, they're anglers. Uh-huh. That's not like the people that just happen to buy something or whatever. Right. Like, this is direct money from hunters and anglers. I would be really curious to know, and if anybody listening has an article or has numbers, I would love to hear that about just, even the national organizations.
Uh-huh.
But, so... So you're not only an angler, but you're a hunter as well. And
absolutely.
You just got off a pretty intense pronghorn hunt. You know, it was pretty epic from how you were describing it to me.
Right. Yeah, it was funny because before that, you know, coming off archery season, I did 13 days of actual hunting, and that was such an intense hunt and, you know, kind of everything you'd expect archery elk hunting to be. And then to go to pronghorn, which is a very much more social and laid back hunt I had an opportunity to harvest a doe yesterday that, you know, I spent more time, actually in the car driving back and forth out to the Eastern Plains than I did during the actual hunt. But, you know, it just happened to be that was in a good spot, had a good chunk of land, and just rolled up to the right little wash and saw some antelope coming up the hill. And so I snuck back down into the drainage and got down below them so they couldn't see me, and snuck around, and ended up, they came right down the little drainage wash right to me at 75 yards, which, you know, normally when people think about rifle pronghorn hunting, it's usually not less than a three-digit number that you're shooting, yeah, you know, for the most part. So to have her come into 75 yards and just stand there perfectly broadside and a nice clean kill and you know, a quick harvest, it was refreshing.
Well, it was so funny because, you know, I had messaged you, and yeah, you know, we'd been talking back and forth for the past week or so, and I'm like, okay, yeah, let's find a time to sync up and record a podcast. And I'd message you, and you're like, and funny enough, you messaged me like an hour after I messaged you, like, sorry it took so long to get back to you. I'm like, really? But you're like, yeah, I was just pulling out a pronghorn. I'm like, wait, what? Weren't you just, I'm so confused right now. Right. I thought you just got back from a hunt.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, I hadn't even planned on going pronghorn hunting that day, but, I got the call that, you know, I had some friends that were out there, and they were having pretty good success, with their tags. And so they invited me to come out to that property, and yeah, it was nice. It was not the most difficult hunt, but it's such a different, anybody that's pronghorn hunted before too, it's such a different country, you know, I spend so much time chasing deer and elk that it's really, and I guess refreshing is the best word I can just use to describe it, because it's just different country, but it still has its own unique challenges, and it's just different, but it's still fun in its own way. So,
yeah. Well, and I feel like, especially after, like, and I know it was tough in Arizona, and from everything I heard from folks in Colorado, the rut was really tough up here too. And I think just how warm it's been and how dry it's been too. But after a hunt like that, where you've busted your ass, like you have killed yourself to get that hunt done. Sometimes it's nice to just go grocery shopping.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah.
And it's, I was kind of thinking about doing that on my way up. I was looking at doe tags and cow tags, like in kind of some more densely populated areas. Right. And I'm like, what could I do on the way up? Just throw a little bit more in the freezer, you know, on the way. And I keep getting distracted by fly fishing. Gosh, man.
That's always my dilemma. Every September and October, that is every year. It's, you know, I have such a limited time to hunt, you know, that I always put that first, but I know I'm always missing out on excellent fishing as well, because, you know, the water's low and clear. You get these beautiful bluebird days here in Colorado. And so, yeah, I always know that I'm foregoing one fun activity for the other. So
it's a tough life to live.
Right.
We're so oppressed.
So much pity. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, it's just motivation to work harder, fill your tag that much faster.
Right. Right. Yep.
I mean, it's really an amazing thing. And I've kind of realized it this year. You know, it's having the opportunity to having so many choices and literally struggling to decide what amazing outdoor activity are you going to do? How amazing is it that we have this opportunity?
It's incredible. I mean, especially in Colorado, you know, if all the tags that I have available to me right now is stunning. I filled the one pronghorn tag now, but I still have two tags for next weekend. I have another buck tag in another unit, another buck pronghorn, and I've got an elk tag as well for first season rifle. So it's, and then I still have a mule deer buck tag and a mule deer late doe tag. So I don't have that much freezer space. So I have to be a little bit, you know, cognizant of how much meat I'm harvesting. But, you know, it's fun because you've got friends and family that they always welcome taking some wild game. And so there's always somebody that's going to take it. But,
well, I mean, that's like the, you know, kind of the oldest saying in the book. And I've talked about it a lot. And I think Shane Mahoney, like, has like known for talking about this, is the whole idea of, you know, you wouldn't like go to your neighbor and be like, I went to the grocer and bought you this ribeye. Take it with my blessings. Like, they'd look at you like you're crazy and then probably throw it out because they thought you poisoned it and you're like an insane serial killer or something. But you walk up to your neighbor and be like, hey, man, you know, I hunted this pronghorn. I made some jerky, or, you know, I have this, like, these sausages or whatever it is, you know, whatever you make. People are like, this is awesome.
Absolutely.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And even people that are like skeptical of wild game, they kind of get a little bit excited. I feel like they're like, okay, yeah, I've never had something like this. I'll give it a try. And I was, I finished my hunt and I've got some friends over in Erie.
Mm-hmm.
And, old friends, you know, he's known me probably since I was like 12 or 13. And, you know, I kind of met her through him a few years later. And, I haven't seen him in probably, I mean, what has to be like 10, 12 years. And, came up and I got here earlier than I expected. So I'm like, I'm going to go spend time with my old friends. And we hung out and I pulled out some of the elk brats that I just had made. And I swear we left them in the smoker for 2 hours. Like we did them right.
Yep.
And, they were just crack. They were gold, man. and so we had one or two left over, and we ended up talking, just hanging out, like the neighbors were outside. So we're talking with the neighbors and they saw the big old, you know, elk racks. I mean, I say big old elk rack compared to not having anything sticking out of the back of your truck. The small old elk rack sticking out of the back of my truck. And they're like, oh, and they wanted to know about it. And one of the guys does traditional archery. He doesn't hunt, but does traditional archery and he's an angler. And so we start talking about that and this, man, you know, wild game and get into it. I'm like, I got a couple extra sausages in there. And so I kind of chopped them up and all the neighbors were munching on them. And that's like, cool. Even the kids were trying them.
Yep.
And, you know, of course with the kids, you kind of got to be like, oh, hey, have a bite of this. You're like, you know what that is? and watching the look on their face too, when you're like, that thing was like walking around and talking. I mean, like bugling a week and a half ago.
Yep.
And they're like, whoa.
Well, it was really neat. We had a cool opportunity with my daughter doing remote learning. You know, the elk heart or the heart of an animal is usually the first thing that we eat now. I mean, I've come to absolutely love that. Literally, I'll eat that before a tenderloin, before the backstrap, a heart, especially of an elk heart, you know, where it's large enough, is priority number one for us. And so when I came back from that elk hunt, we contacted my daughter's teacher and asked, you know, would they be interested in seeing this heart? Cause I had this giant heart, you know, from this bull elk. And sure enough, she thought it was a great idea. You know, we got on this Zoom call, with my daughter, with her class, some of them that were doing the in-person learning. And, she got to, you know, kind of explain, you know, how I hunted it and got to show, you know, hold it. And I mean, it was a bull, a bull's heart is not a small,
or, I mean, that's like a two-handed
muscle. Yeah.
And how old is she?
She's eight.
Eight.
So
okay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's as big as her head.
Second, third grade?
Second grade. Yeah.
Second grade.
Yep. So just for her to be able to share that and then for her to explain that, you know, I'm going to eat this tonight. You know, my dad just got this over the weekend we're going to eat this tonight. We're going to cut this up and this is going to become our meal. And it was kind of neat for her to share that experience with her fellow students. And
yeah.
And like you said, there's something about the wild game that definitely brings people together. You know, I know we already like this, even this pronghorn, we already have plans to cook up the backstrap in a certain recipe that we use with some of our friends because we've talked this recipe up so much that it's such a good way to prepare it that we're like, all right, we're going to have a special night and we're going to cook up this backstrap for everybody. So
now you can't like pull that out and not share the recipe. You can't be like, is it like a secret family recipe or is it like something you can,
it's not a secret recipe at all. It's,
at least give us the basics here.
So it's essentially you kind of butterfly cut the backstrap. So you almost cut it out. You know, it's typically kind of a roll almost, you know, kind of a round shape with a backstrap. You basically butterfly cut it so it lays out flat so you can roll it back up with stuff in it. I actually, if you do a search on YouTube for Fred Eichler, it was his wife that did a YouTube video quite a few years ago that I originally found it, and I believe it's still out there. But you basically cut that meat so you can stuff it. You put is it Bourdain cheese? I think something along those lines.
Okay.
It's kind of a real, you know, almost not quite a goat cheese, but something along those lines. And then some Montreal seasoning, steak seasoning in it, and then some roasted peppers and onions. And then you basically roll it all back up and then just roast it on the grill, until it's done to your desired temperature. And then you just kind of slice it into almost like pinwheels. You know, if you think of those like ham pinwheels from a kid, that's kind of what it looks like when it's done, but it's absolutely beautiful.
That's funny. Like, so I was, when I got my elk processed, I took the processor because I'm like, I'm going to be on the road for like the next month.
Right.
I don't want to just be carrying around these quarters. I want to be able to eat some of this.
Yep.
So, took it to the processor and he was talking about, what he does. I had him do one of the back straps as roast, the other one just as steaks.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about, he has a very similar roast recipe where he butterflies it twice.
Okay.
And I can't remember everything he uses. I have like a note to remind myself when I'm home to call him up and be like, okay, I need the
The specifics.
And he calls them like backstrap cinnamon rolls, even though they're not cinnamon rolls, but they kind of have, like you said, that same kind of circular thing. And he's like, it's like cream cheese and this and that,
right.
And they're bacon wrapped and like the whole thing. And they're like it's the most decadent sounding.
Definitely.
And it's one of those things. I feel like you look at it, you're like, oh, I could eat a ton of that. And you take, you have like two slices and you're like, dear Lord, I'm so full right now. I don't know what to do.
Absolutely. No, that is, there's all these different aspects about hunting and it means so many different things for so many people, but that is a whole nother aspect of it, of just what you can do with the meat after you've harvested it and mm-hmm. how you can share it during special occasions. And it's great.
And I mean, I'm the last person to be like, oh yes, I'm just a meat hunter. I'm like, no, like, again, there's so many, and again, it's too many reasons to count. Everyone has their own individual reasons, their own insights, their own background, their own history, why they hunt, their relationship with it, what it means to them. It's so insanely individual, And, we try and kind of dominate. It's like, oh, it's the adventure. It's the meat. It's this, that, the other, and... there's excitement. We almost want to shy away from being like, it's fun.
Right.
Like, even aside, it's just like being out there pitting yourself against something. It's exciting and it's fun because, we want to present the narrative in a good way.
Sure.
And don't want to turn people off. And I just wrote a whole article about that. But it's, we don't want to sound like bloodthirsty, crazed killers or something like that.
Right.
But it's fun. But there's nothing I've come to realize, and I never thought I would be this person. I thought I would always love the food, but I never realized how much it actually would mean to me
mm-hmm.
to win. It's Christmas dinner. Like I did backstrap. I did whitetail backstrap.
Okay.
I actually didn't harvest this whitetail. I didn't see any bucks coming through. And so I didn't take anything. Cause I also didn't know much about whitetail hunting and that you could shoot a doe and a buck would still come in. Live and learn. But I've done that. I've done a lot of stuff with the family, but for Christmas dinner, I processed the whole deer myself. I did all of this. I cooked it. And we do, one of my favorite things to do with backstrap. It's like a combo of couple recipes. I use, Jeremiah Dowdy from Field to Plate.
Hmm.
I use his super juice recipe. I'll marinate them overnight.
Okay.
And then drop in the sous vide for like 6 hours. And it's, you already got the backstrap. This thing's already like ready to fall apart.
Right.
You put that thing in the sous vide for 6 hours. It's almost like it's the texture of a roast almost. So you pop it out, just sear it on both sides, use the drippings with like some garlic and some cream, make like a nice little sauce, drizzle it over the top. And this stuff is it's just crack. Like, and it falls apart like a roast almost, but it's the richest, just heartiest meal you've ever had. And
sounds great.
Like, you're sitting there, and I just take a moment sometimes, and I sit back, and it's like nothing, out of the blue. It's like any meal with the family. Everyone's laughing and joking and smiling. Mm-hmm. But there's that internal moment where you look at that, and you're like, I was responsible for this.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I had from start to finish, I took part in this. And there are few things in this world that brings me that much joy than having my whole family together. You know, like my nephews, my folks, my brother and my sister, and their, you know, my brother and sister-in-laws, and like everyone together and seeing that, like, it, like, I'm getting a little choked up thinking about it right
sure,
now.
Sure,
like,
yeah.
It's probably the fact that I've had a beer and a half, but I'm going to blame it on that. Someone's got allergies in here, man.
It's the smoke.
I'm allergic. Yeah, it's the smoke. Yeah, damn, Colorado's on fire. California's on fire. But yeah, there's very few things in this world that bring me more joy than that. And I never expected it.
Yep.
Never, ever in a million years would have called that part of it out.
Mm-hmm. No, it's, there's something definitely special about sharing it with others that, like you said, you know what went into it, and to even try to briefly explain, you know, what it took to get that animal to that table, you know, whether they're hunters or non-hunters, it's always neat to share even a little bit of the experience with them. So,
yeah. And I mean, it's like, and it just tastes damn good.
It sure
like,
does. Yeah.
There's, you know, I always have this argument with people, the whole term gamey. I love it and I hate it. I mean, because it has such a negative connotation, uh-huh. I try and avoid using it. But it's like, you know, it's like somebody going in and buying a beef, you know, like used to eating beefsteak. Then they go buy a pork chop and treat it exactly like a beefsteak.
True,
expect
yeah.
it to taste exactly the same.
That's a great comparison. Yeah, I mean, that's great.
I'm like, it's a different freaking animal.
Yep.
Why would you expect it to taste exactly the same? Just because it kind of looks the same.
Right. No, that's a great point.
And I'm like, okay. And, you know, people are like, oh, well, you have to cook it to cover up the taste. I'm like, well, okay. Yeah, you have to cook pork to cover up the taste, or you cook it to complement it. Like, what's the difference in anything you cook unless you're just expecting it, yeah, to be a cow?
Mm-hmm.
But I could go on and rant about that, but I will choose not to. So, man, say somebody comes into the shop here, you know, it's a touristy town, you know, they say somebody's walking by, they're in the outdoors, they come in and they're like, oh, what's this place? And you're showing them around. Like, you know, man, really like what you got going on here. I've always kind of been interested in like fishing and hunting, all this stuff, but like, I don't know. I don't have background. I don't know anybody that does it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stuff to learn and like skills and rules and regulations, this, that, and the other. It's like, I don't know if I can do this. Like, it sounds cool, but I don't know if it's for me. It's a lot of stuff to learn.
Right.
What would you tell someone like that? What words of encouragement would you give them?
I mean, the beauty of these days is there are so many resources available to learn, whether it's hunting or fishing. You know, it's, you can learn the basic steps of either just by, you know, reading magazines. You know, YouTube is an incredible resource these days. You know, obviously podcasts are, I mean, I've hunted my entire life and I still listen to different podcasts and pick up tips and tricks and things like that. I mean, it's amazing. That, which is what, one of the things that I think I'm so attracted to hunting and fishing is that it literally is a lifetime learning hobby or sport or whatever you want to call it, that I still learn something new about animals. I learn something new about fish, the entomology of flies and things like that. I mean, it's incredible.
I feel like the more experienced you get, the better you get at it, the more you realize there is to learn. Like the guys, you know, you're kind of in this, when you're in this like middle level, you're like, okay, you know, once I get to this point, I'm kind of there. You don't know enough to understand there is like an infinite amount more for you to learn. And I feel like the guys at the top almost understand that. They almost have a sense of like how much more there is to learn, way more than you do when you're just starting out.
100%. Yeah. So, you know, if I was giving advice to somebody, I would say, get started with the basics, do your own homework and kind of get that foundation laid. But then whether it's taking some type of class, you know, if it's on the hunting side, go take your hunter's education and get that kind of under your belt, and then find a mentor, you know, whether it's joining a, a TU chapter and just finding other people that you can go fishing with, to, you know, just your internet meetup groups, whether it's on Facebook or just meetup stuff like that.
Or just start a podcast and like ask and just show up places, right, and be like, hey, guess what we're doing?
Right.
We're talking and we're fishing.
Yeah, for sure. No, I mean, it's that they both, that is the cool thing about hunting and fishing in general, though, is that they both have very good communities, and there are usually people willing to share their knowledge and to teach you. So, you know, you might have to find the right person to do that, but they're out there. So take advantage of it.
I think I've said it a million times. I don't know a single angler or hunter that if you like were genuine about it and you're like, hey man, I just kind of want to talk hunt with you and like learn a little bit of stuff from you. Hunters and anglers are the worst about wanting to talk about the crap they love. Are you kidding me? Like, I mean, I know specifically for myself, I've made several people regret asking questions before.
Right.
4 hours later.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah, that was a really awkward date. Anyway.
No, I mean, I've had multiple people, not only on the fishing side, but also on the hunting side. And for me, I mean, it's such a joy to take people out that literally have a clean slate and don't know what to expect. And just showing them the excitement of, you know, whether it's a big bull coming in or just any animal, you know, if you're out hunting and you just even see an animal, you don't even have to have a harvest or take a shot, but just to have an animal come close to you and they don't know that you're there. There's something pretty unique about that you just can't get that type of experience from, you know, going to a national park and sitting in a car looking at animals or something like that. Like, there's just something more intimate about it that you know that you've tricked the senses of that animal and you've shared something special with it. So being able to show that type of experience to new hunters has been pretty fun. I've done that a few times already with people that wanted to get into hunting and asked me to take them and kind of just show them the ropes. And I think it's great.
Yeah. There's a special authenticity and depth to it. That's not present. Like, definitely not when you're, you know, you got the family in the truck,
right,
and you're cruising by and you see like the elk asleep 10 feet from the road there.
Yep.
But yeah, there it's, even you don't even get that when hiking.
No.
Like, I probably talked about this a million times. Everyone's probably rolling their eyes at me because I'm saying it again. But it's being a part of it versus being an observer.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great way to say it. Yep.
So, folks want to check out all the gear, find you online, follow along, see all the remaining pronghorn hunts.
Right.
Where can they find you online?
Yeah, so actually pretty easy to find. You know, our website is basinandbend.com, all written out. On Instagram, it's basinandbend, and on Facebook, it's basinandbend. Those are probably our most popular or most active channels. Also on YouTube, do some videos up there too, under basinandbend too. So keep it simple.
So pretty much type basinandbend anywhere.
Yep.
And you'll find it. So where does explain the name really quick before we go?
So the thought was, you know, just because of the hunting and fishing aspect of it, you know, thinking of the basin of, you know, if you're up high in an alpine basin hunting and then the bend of a river.
There you go.
So kind of combine those two and that focus on what we love, and those are the places we like to be. So
awesome. Well, I'll make sure to link to all of that on the show notes page. Glad we finally got really sync up again and sit down, chat, get a little fishing done.
You bet. It was fun.
All right, y'all, that'll do it for this episode of The Wild Initiative. Make sure to check out the show notes page at thewildinitiative.com. Get links to everything we talked about in today's episode. That'll do it for this week. Looking forward to next time. But until then, I hope this podcast inspired you to get involved, get outdoors, and plan your initiative for the wild.
Thank you for listening to The Wild Initiative. Please take a moment to leave a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher. And head on over to thewildinitiative.com to get show notes, check out the blog, gear discounts, other podcasts from the Wild Initiative family, and more.